Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, December 28th, 2014, and this is show number 503 and the very last show of 2014. I have to tell you, this week is a perfect example of how the community for the No Silicast comes through for me. We had a 13-step process to celebrate Christmas this year, starting on December 23rd and extending to December 28th, as in today. We shuttled five family members, two dogs, through five Christmases, five cities, and even a trip to the airport for my daughter to go to Mexico with her husband. We basically skidded around the corner into our driveway less than 2 hours ago. So without the community, you'd be listening to pretty much dead air right now. It started with Bart agreeing to do Chit Chat Across the Pond almost a week early with Taming the Terminal Part 26 event all about DHCP, which was really, really interesting to me. Stephen Getz, also known as Goatman, sent in a review of Gas Cubby Free. Alistair came through with an unsolicited testimonial for Hover. Nightwise reviews the inventive and interesting Yoda phone. Dor tells us about the Qbox i2EX. And in Dumb Question Corner, Steve, also known as Husband Steve, agreed to answer our dumb question from Timo from Finland. I gotta say, what's that song, I Get By With a Little Help from My Friends? Well, before we kick in, during Chit Chat Across the Pond, you're going to hear Bart ask for feedback on what you think about Security Lite and what kind of changes you might like to see. He's questioning where you see the value. What kind of things do you like or don't like about the segment? For some reason, he thinks it needs to be changed up, so he wants to know what you think. He posted the question in our Google Plus community after we did the recording over at podfeet.com/Google Plus, and there's a link directly to it in the show notes. He's already gotten a ton of feedback about it just from it being in the Google Plus community. Like I said, there's a link in the show notes. So you can jump right in there and tell him what you think. It's a great reason to get into our Google Plus community while you're at it. If you want to be notified when things are posted in there, be sure to click on the little bell symbol right above the logo on the left-hand side. You can turn it off at any time, which is nice, but if it's on, you get an email when somebody posts. I personally find the community just chatty enough, but not too chatty. You know, one or two posts a day kind of thing. Hope you come over and let Bart know what you think about Security Lite and give him some feedback. All right, let's get started with our first listener review.
Hi, my name is Stephen Getz, and I would like to review the iPhone app Gas Cubby for you. But first, the problem to be solved. My car has a turbocharged high-compression engine, and the manufacturer recommends we use premium fuel. The manual does state that regular fuel can be used, but we may experience a loss in power and fuel mileage. In my area, premium fuel can be quite a bit more expensive than regular gas. I want an iPhone app that would let me track and record my car's mileage. Gas Cubby is a free, ad-supported app that has been around for a long time. It features support for multiple vehicles, tracking of fill-ups and service costs, support for imperial metric and U.S. measurements. You can also set up alerts that would let you know when it's time to get an oil change or other regular service. It will also graph out your fuel mileage, allowing you to see trends in your fuel use or if gas from different stations or of different grades affect your mileage. I haven't been using it long enough to see if the regular gas will indeed give me less mileage, making the switch from premium a draw cost-wise, but I do feel that once I get enough data into the app, it will be useful. You can also export all your entered data into a .csv file for use in a spreadsheet of your choice, or for importing it into another mileage tracking app, or into the very useful website Fuelly, which not only allows you to track your vehicle's mileage, but you can compare your mileage to other users who drive the same make and model. There's room for improvement. First, the UI is very dated. It very much feels like an iOS 3 app. I also wish there were ways to turn off info fields that appear when adding a fill-up. Some people may find fields like location, brand, payment type, and tire pressures useful. I personally don't, and they make the UI more cluttered than necessary. If you find the ads intrusive, you can buy an ad-free version and import your data with a built-in feature which allows you to upload your data to the Gas Cubby server, which provides a backup of your data. So in the end, I would recommend this app for anyone who wants to track the mileage or service visits of one or more vehicles. Please visit my website at www.stephengetz.ca, spelled STEVENGOETZ, for my blog and to check out my photography. Thanks for listening and goodbye for now.
Well, thanks, Stephen. This thing sounds really fun. Now, you know what a metrics nerd I am, so this is just right up my alley. By the way, to everybody else, if you're looking for this app, be sure to search on Gas Cubby Free. You can try that at first, and if you want to upgrade, you can buy Gas Cubby for $2 in the App Store. Like Stephen, the reviews, though, on iTunes are kind of hot and cold on Gas Cubby. For free, there's no risk, of course, but for some reason, the paid version in its latest release is getting some pretty harsh reviews, while the free version's doing well. Well, the odd thing is the paid-for version for all of their versions is getting has 4 stars, but the latest version is not doing very well at all. In any case, I hope Gas Cubby Free will do what you're looking for. And I really appreciate Stephen. He's been the little tempter who actually helped talk me into getting my Micro Four Thirds camera, and he's helped me pick out lenses, and he's one of those guys who's really, really good at helping people spend their money. So I think he does that vicariously, and then he doesn't spend it himself. All right, next up, let's hear from Alistair.
Hello, Alison and the NoCilla Castaways. Alistair here from New Zealand once again with a word from about our sponsor. No, not that sponsor, the other one. I became a customer of Hover in June 2011 when I first registered my macthoughts.net domain. I don't recall how I heard about them, but I think it was from a podcast I had been listening to. The promise was simple. Affordable, simple, no upsell. 3.5 years later, that promise is still being delivered upon. I now have 17 domains with Hover. When I first became a customer, they didn't offer any .nz domains, but since then they have added many of our standard second-level domains and have promised me that there are more coming. I'm transferring everything I can across from my previous New Zealand-based registrar just as soon as I can. Just recently, New Zealand opened up the second level to allow any domain to end with .nz, and while trying to secure one of these, I experienced what Hover customer service is. Many of you will know my online handle, ZKARJ. The very first domain I bought was zkarj.co.nz, which I've had since 2001. I had transferred this to Hover some time ago and now needed to prove I owned it in order to register the new zkarj.nz. Unfortunately, these domains are so new, Hover cannot provide them for me, so I needed to register the new domain with my New Zealand registrar. This process involves a unique code that Hover would generate. It is variously called an authorization code or UDAI. I located the code on my Hover account and set about proving my ownership. Entering the code provided by Hover, I got an error that the code was not accepted. I double and triple checked and kept getting the same error. I checked with the New Zealand registrar and they just said, "We can't help, your registrar needs to provide the correct code." Time for Hover support. The first response was from Roger, who confirmed what I was doing should work, but I needed to perform another step on Hover. I tried this and got another error on Hover. I emailed this back to Roger. The next day, another response from Roger began, "I've done some further investigation," and went on to describe some recent changes in the .nz registry rules and how it appeared my original domain had been caught up in these changes. He had made some changes behind the scenes at Hover and asked me to try again. Another error. I responded again and noted something I had come across at the old registrar about the exact makeup of the code. Roger responded once more, beginning, "I'm not exactly sure what's happening," and continuing to describe how he had researched the .nz domain rules himself and believed everything should be in order, but he had escalated my problem within Hover. In the end, it took a couple of weeks for them to get to the bottom of the problem, but throughout that time I got several updates from Roger about what was happening until finally he emailed me and said a brand new code had been generated and could I please try it. It worked. Now, you might think the takeaway from this episode is that Hover had the wrong code and couldn't figure out how to generate the correct one, but I take another view. I dealt with exactly one person at Hover, Roger. He was speaking to me at the same level as I was speaking to him. None of this turn it off and on again nonsense or scripted answers, just straight talk at a reasonably technical level that I had illustrated I could understand. He kept me updated as soon as anything changed, even if there was no resolution yet or further steps for me to take. Every update gave me more information on what was happening, what their thinking was, and whether I needed to do anything or provide any more information. When I finally responded that it had worked, I got a cheery response from Roger, who seemed as glad as I was that it was resolved. Most of the time, I find Hover incredibly simple to use. But domain names can be complicated, and it is comforting to know that the people behind the scenes can be so tenacious at rooting out a complex problem such as this. I cannot recommend them enough.
Well, Alistair, thank you so much for sending in this, like I said, unsolicited testimonial. You know, I'm getting great support from them. They answer all my questions, and I've had one guy, Mark, helping me with a tricky problem. But to hear it from someone who's not being paid to talk about them makes it that much better. I've gotten so many emails and tweets endorsing Hover, people saying, oh, yeah, I love those guys. Glad they're supporting the show. So that's pretty cool. Now, remember, this is the last week to use the coupon code PODFEET12, all lowercase, to get 10% off if you're a new customer over at hover.com. Now, I know this is a dangerous maneuver, but I'm going to turn the microphone over to Nightwise.
Hello, Allison. This is Nightwise from the Nightwise.com podcast, and I want to give you a quick review of an Android phone I played with this week. The Android phone I got in my hands this week is not very impressive. It's a 4.3-inch standard Android phone with a slightly older Android 4.1 operating system, a 12-megapixel camera, 32 gigabytes of storage, and a standard resolution screen of 1280 by 720 pixels. Not very impressive. You see a lot of these phones in the medium price range. The thing that does impress me is when you put the phone down. Just put it face down on the table, and then the Yota phone really comes to life. Because on the back of the Yota phone, there is a second display. Integrated into the back casing with exactly the same color is an e-paper display. This e-paper display allows the Yota phone to display information both on the front and on the back. The back of the phone is a way to glance at your phone and quickly get the information you need. For example, you can customize it to display a dashboard with the clock, your upcoming calendars, your last emails, your notifications, and anything that you want to know. Because this is an e-paper display, it doesn't use any power. It just uses power when it needs to switch around from one screen to the other. So if there's a new notification, the screen gets updated, and your phone doesn't use any power. It's really cool to look at because the e-ink display looks like it's part of the casing of the phone, like it's really something that is drawn on top of the back casing of the phone, while in fact it is a display. So this way you can really put your phone down and quickly, at a glance, take a look at the time and your notifications on the back of your phone. But it doesn't stop there. It's an e-ink display that is touch-sensitive, so you can also scroll through the various screens and go check your calendar, write an email, take a look at your notifications. You can just swipe through the screen because it's touch-sensitive. And it really gets interesting when you are running out of battery power. We all know that these big displays that we have use a lot of power. E-ink displays don't. So you can disable the primary screen of the Yota phone, the LCD screen, and operate the phone entirely using the e-ink display. Almost all of the applications are available. Of course, you can't watch YouTube videos on an e-ink display because of the refresh rate that's pretty low. But it is a great way to operate your phone when you are in need of battery power. When you only have, let's say, 30 minutes left using your standard screen, you can switch that off, switch to the e-paper display, and have 6 or 7 hours of battery time at your disposal. The e-ink display is also great in sunlight because it doesn't reflect, and it's a great tool or a great extra addition to the phone. I thought that the Yota phone was really interesting. The product is a first generation product and it's a little bit too expensive. At $699, it's too much for a first generation product, but it isn't quite there yet, but the idea is brilliant. I am waiting for an Android tablet or an iPad with a standard display on one end and an e-paper display on the other end, allowing you to watch multimedia on the front of your tablet and read e-books at the back of your tablet. The only thing that I can say is that people will probably think you're nuts when you use the Yota phone, because you will be using your phone backwards. You will be tapping on the back of your phone, and if people don't know what you're doing, you look like a complete idiot, because they'll say, hey, dummy, you have your phone the other way around. But who knows, perhaps that's going to be the way we are going to do things in the future. Two screens, an e-ink on one end and a standard display on the other. Great tool to play with, the Yota phone. If we can get it into our hands a little bit longer, we might be able to do a review on Nightwise.com. If so, I'll keep you posted. Until then, this was Nightwise of the Nightwise.com podcast, the podcast for hacks, tips, and tweaks for cross-platform geeks. Wishing you, Nasilla Castaways, a great time.
Well, Nightwise, that was really, really interesting. You know, this phone sounds like it's breaking some real new ground that other phones haven't done before. But dang, is that baby expensive. I put a link in the show notes to the Yota phone on Amazon in case one of you guys wants to buy it. I want the commission on this one because it's listed at just under $1,000. Please head on over and click the link in the show notes. All right, last week you had the fun of meeting Dor from the Podnuts Network on Chit Chat Across the Pond, and this week he kept on giving. He agreed to give us a review of a cool little product he's been really enjoying. I have a feeling this is the kind of thing that Donald Burr is just going to love. Anyway, let's listen to Dor next.
Hello, Allison. Hello, NoSillaCast. This is Door-to-Door Geek, a.k.a. Steve McLaughlin from Podnuts.com and podcasts like Android App Addicts and Linux for the rest of us. Going to give you a quick review on this microcomputer called a Qbox, C-U-B-O-X. You can find it at solid-run.com. This little 2x2-inch computer uses a micro SD card for the hard drive, and you can run full Linux desktop on it or Android or a XBMC derivative on it, so it can be a very good home theater computer. Out of the box, the one I got comes with a dual core processor, gig of RAM, gigabit Ethernet, two USB ports, HDMI port, eSATA port, IR sensor on the front, and a power port. Now, technically, I believe I can power it through the micro USB plug, but I use the dedicated power socket. It came with a 4 gigabyte card, which if you're going to use for stuff like Netflix or Plex or other video streaming services, this will probably be just fine. I will say after I bought my box, they did come out with a Qbox TV, Qbox TV. This is definitely a little bit of a better box. This is a quad core processor, still 2x2x2 inch, gigabit Ethernet. 8 gig SD card comes on it, 1 gig of RAM, your typical Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, AC, two USB, HDMI, eSATA, everything that comes out of the box on the other one too. And this one is only $119. This is probably the best bang for the buck. Now I will tell people, there's a little ad thing I'm going to put in here, link in the notes to an Android application called Servers Ultimate. I encourage people to get the pro version because it has unfettered access to the list of servers that can run. But using the USB on the back of the Qbox, you can hook up an external hard drive. So you can turn this into a fanless, quiet server in your house. And you can run virtually every kind of server imaginable. That is not a joke. Virtually every kind of server imaginable, from DHCP, DNS, FTP, HTTP, HTTPS, IRC, SQL Server, ICAP, Gopher Server, Git Server, NTP Server, NFS Server, Proxy Server, RSync Server, SMNP Server, web servers of all kinds, email servers, Telnet servers, VNC servers, WebDAV servers. The list is insane. I encourage people, please go take a look at this application. This is the application I show people to show the full power of Android. With this little $100 box, with this $1 or $2 apps, you can literally have full-fledged servers on your network with zero maintenance or upkeep to them. This is a great little combination. I want to thank Allison for letting me come on NoSillaCast again, and I will talk to everyone soon.
I love stuff like this, Dor. This is such a cool idea, and it's so simple. If it weren't already past Christmas, totally would have been on my Christmas list, but maybe, you know, my birthday's only in a couple months. It'd be fun to have. Anyway, thank you so much for sending it in, and please do more reviews for us in the future.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
I think the thing I like about Dumb Question Corner the most is getting to play Victor Cahiao's recording. You know, I just love it. Anyway, this week I've asked Steve to come on and answer our dumb question because this one was completely out of my league. Let's go ahead and listen to Steve.
Listener Timo from Finland sent in the following dumb question that he says was inspired by, quote, all of the Taming the Terminal episodes. Timo asks the following question. I know that computers ultimately only understand binary code, i.e. ones and zeros, but what are the ones and zeros exactly? Since numbers are a human abstraction, I don't expect to see little ones and zeros zipping around a computer chip if I put a working motherboard under a microscope. Physically, what do the ones and zeros of code actually represent in the internal workings of a computer? Well, Timo, it's good to see Taming the Terminal has inspired you to question how computers actually work, and your question is a good one. You're quite correct, you won't see microscopic ones and zeros buzzing around your computer's CPU if you examine it with a microscope. But with a very good microscope, you can see the electronics, namely the transistors, that actually make the ones and zeros. To better answer your question, let's back up a little to talk about what a computer chip really is and what it does. The transistor is the fundamental building block of nearly all modern-day computers. A transistor is the collection of electronic circuitry that implements the ones and zeros in a digital computer. A transistor can change its output voltage and current based on a control signal coming into it. Think of a transistor like a water valve, where the water flow is the output voltage and the faucet handle is the control signal. Originally, transistors were discrete devices, i.e. one transistor to a package, that you soldered onto an electronic circuit board. As technology moved along, transistors were made smaller and integrated into a single package called an integrated circuit. As they got smaller, they also required less power and they became faster. Technology has now advanced to the point that billions of transistors can fit on a single computer chip. For example, Apple's A8 dual-core microprocessor that you find in an iPhone 6 or 6 Plus has 2 billion transistors embedded in a single chip measuring just under 1 centimeter on a side. In order for your computer to make decisions and carry out calculations, these billions of transistors are wired together in various combinations in an integrated circuit to create logic gates like the AND or OR functions. A logic gate takes as its input two logic values, either of which can be a 1 or a 0, and outputs a 1 or a 0 depending on the gate's particular function and its input values. The ones and zeros on the input and output of a logic gate are actually indicated by small voltages on the input and output of the transistors that make up the logic gate. These voltages are very small, on the order of 2 to 5 volts depending on the semiconductor design. For this example, let's just pick 3 volts as the operating voltage for our transistor and logic gates. A logic 1, then, is indicated by 3 volts, while a logic 0 is indicated by 0 volts, as measured at the transistor's inputs and outputs. So, in answer to your question, the ones and zeros zipping around your computer chip are represented by very small voltages on the input and output of the billions of transistors in your computer's CPU. Thanks for sending in your question, Timo. Hope I've helped answer it. Oh, and be sure to stay subscribed.
Well, thanks for answering that, husband Steve. I had a vague idea of a little bit of that, but I sure learned a bunch more from your explanation. I think if I'd been the one to answer, my full explanation back to Timo would have been, it's not ones and zeros, it's some voltage and then some not voltage. And that's why our marriage works so well. We complement each other's skills within the technical realm, and we don't know anything else. For Christmas this year, Dorothy, also known as Mac Lurker, bought her father and stepmother an iPad for Christmas. The main idea is for them to be able to converse with their grandchild over FaceTime. The computer and Skype is a bit too much for them at this point, so an iPad seemed like a good solution. Dorothy knows her dad really well and decided that if she tried to teach him too much stuff, look, Dad, there's apps and email and you can tweet. He'd just hide the iPad under a book and pretend he'd lost it. So she figured if she could just get him to FaceTime with an iPad, that would be a victory. And maybe eventually he'd have some curiosity on what else this newfangled contraption could do. She did go to his house and teach him how to use it, but you know that's not going to be enough. She decided to use Clarify to make him a very simple tutorial showing him what it would look like when someone called, what button to push, and how to even initiate a call himself. She took screenshots of her own iPad, dropped in some lovely rounded rectangles with arrows pointing to the buttons, and explaining what they did. I liked her use of colors as well. I tend to only use red arrows, but she had some red, some pink that matched the sweatshirt she was wearing in the images. I like how she did this as just one big image per page. So the whole thing is like 5 pages long, but there's only one concept per page, so it's not so overwhelming. I like the inventive use of screenshots with real people to make this a great tutorial. If you got people you need to teach and want to introduce new things to them more easily, you might want to head over to clarify-it.com and download a free trial of Clarify and see how much fun it is to help others like Dorothy does. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz, and I think we got a lot of fun in store today, huh, Bart?
I hope so.
Yeah.
Been a slightly hectic day because I can't read calendars.
I love that we have a calendar, though, because it got rid of the "no, you said" on both sides.
Yeah, so we have a calendar where we put in every time I'm going to do Chit Chat Across the Pond, and Allison sent me an email this afternoon saying, so just confirming a run in 2 hours, right? And I was like, ah, I thought it was tomorrow. And I looked at the calendar and I was like, oh, shoot, it's my mistake.
I hate it when you can't blame anybody but yourself. That just sucks the fun out of it.
Yes. So it's now 20:11 in the PM here. And so basically from 4 PM until now, I've been frantically writing, briefly eating, and frantically writing.
Well, that's good. Let's go ahead and kick in. I think it's going to be a lot of fun today.
I hope so. So Security Light, actually, before we kick in, if people could, I'm still having second thoughts about how the segment works out because I'm just not quite happy with it. So if people would like to express their views on the wonderful NosillaCast Google Plus community, that would be most useful.
Ah, like how much, maybe you should start a post that says,
yeah,
you know, too long, too short, not enough, too detailed, you know, what do you guys think? What parts do you like?
Yes,
what parts bore you
to
tears?
I'll start a post within the next 24 hours-ish. Actually, given that we're pre-recording this for next weekend, I have lots of time to start
a post.
We should
probably, yeah, but that means we'll never do it.
No, I'll do it within 24 hours.
Okay, good.
Okay, because it's, I don't know, maybe everyone loves it and I'm just being silly, but I don't know, I have my spidey sense says that this could be better.
Okay,
so
let's
see what comes out of it. So, getting stuck in, important security updates. The only one that crossed my mind is good old Patch Tuesday, which both Microsoft and Adobe made use of. So, if you're running Microsoft products, patch them. If you're running Adobe products, yeah, patch them.
There you go.
And then we get on to the important news section. So, the first thing we definitely have to talk about is the latest cutesy-named bug, Misfortune Cookie. Because if you don't have a cute name, you're not a real security bug anymore.
Right.
It doesn't exist. Decided that in the industry. Yeah. So this is another one of those cases where things get messy. So lots of different router manufacturers use the same piece of third-party software, and there's a bug in that piece of third-party software, which means that it's not clear-cut, as in all Zeissels or all Linksys or whatever. So because it's not a Zeissel problem or a Linksys problem, but a problem in software that's shared between lots of manufacturers, it's actually quite difficult to pin down all the routers. But the security company are basically saying there is a vulnerability in 12 million home routers, which allows hijacking of the router. So basically a remote attacker can change the settings on your router, which is bad in many ways.
Wow. I feel like we've heard this song before.
Yes, we have, indeed.
Come back and say that Apple routers are affected.
They are not, actually, according to the list. So the company in question is, was it Turning Point? Sugar. Checkpoint, not Turning Point. Checkpoint is the security company who found all this. There is a link in the show notes to a PDF of theirs, which has some basic FAQs in pink for some earthly reason. How does this, you know, what's Misfortune Cookie vulnerability? How many devices are affected? How does it affect me? Is this bad? Which has a one-word answer. Yes. Which is cute.
Wow. Yeah, it does. It says, is that bad? Yes.
If you scroll down further, though, you will find a list in alphabetical order. Now, not alphabetic by manufacturer like a sane person would have done, but alphabetic by model number. Now, there is nothing that starts with Air that is made by Apple, so I'm assuming there are no airports affected.
Right. It's not too long, though. It's two pages, two columns. It's only about 400. Oh, no, it does go a third page. Never mind.
What worries me is pretty much the entire Prestige range from Zycel. And that is just about every modem by many Irish ISPs, because Zycel are really popular over here. With, you know, so like when I'm looking through that list here, I'm just seeing so many big names.
Buffalo. Yeah, I've actually never heard of Zycel before. Z-Y-X-E-L. I hadn't heard of them, but
they're very popular in Europe. I don't know if it's that we have a different type of ADSL or something, but over here they are completely the norm with so many of our ISPs.
Yeah. I'm actually not seeing Linksys.
I thought they were on the list. D-Link definitely are on the list.
Wait, there's one. Let's see. Yeah, there's only one model of Linksys. BEFDSR41W.
Ah, such lovely, memorable names.
Yeah.
Geez, Zycel are just all over the place.
Oh, yeah. It looks almost like it started there. That's a lot.
TP-Link.
Haven't heard of them, yeah. Okay.
One over here, too. Anyway.
Well, people can go look there. If they don't have an Apple router, they probably should go check that out.
They should. And there's also the manufacturers have issued a missive to third-party manufacturers saying it's very important to keep your firmware up to date. So hopefully the manufacturers will take the hint from the people who are the source of this security bug and keep their software up to date.
Oh, yeah. I sort of assume that somewhere in all those links is something that tells you how to update your firmware.
It's going to depend on the manufacturer. So if you find out you're vulnerable, then you go to your manufacturer's webpage and take it from there.
And hope that they're specific and say, this fixes that vulnerability?
Yeah, I'm afraid you're into the hell of trying to figure out. Now, it has a CVE number, which is listed in the linked blog post. So you can ask the question, have you patched for CVE blah?
What is CVE?
These are the common vulnerability something.
Huh, okay.
I used to know what that stood for. Basically, they're numbers given to vulnerabilities in a centralized catalog. So there are a way that security researchers can, without having to give everything a name, you can actually quote its CVE number and everyone knows what you're talking about.
Common vulnerabilities and exposures.
There we go. Okay. So a CVE number is just a universally accepted numbering system for vulnerabilities, and it just makes it easy to know if you're fixed against a certain bug. If you look through Apple's release notes every time OS X is updated, you'll see lots of CVEs.
Hmm. Okay.
So there we go. As I said, I hate these kind of stories because, unfortunately, it's not clear-cut. It's going to completely depend on your manufacturer.
It's almost light. It might be light.
depending on your manufacturer, it may be very light. It may just be log into the interface. There might be a pop-up saying, there's an update. Click yes. Could be that straightforward. Yeah, or it could not.
Yeah. All right.
I think it's good news, although I imagine it's going to make some people's heads explode. So the European Banking Authority are an EU institution, and people are reading the guidelines they've just published, and it would appear that they are mandating that every European financial payment services company, or rather every financial services company operating in Europe, has to have two-factor auth by August 2015.
Okay. Is
that
bad?
That's half a year away. No, it's fantastic, but goodness me, if I was a bank, I'd be worried.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work in the next 8 months.
Is it? It's hiring the right people who know how to do that stuff, right?
Okay, but it's going from zero to a working product,
yeah.
Right? It's a tight
on the most critical thing you do, which is let people in and out of their money. Yeah.
So on the one hand, I think it's ridiculous that it's not mandatory. I mean, it's our money, for God's sake. Of course you should secure it. On the other hand, maybe August 2015 is a little optimistic. But anyway, you know, good news, bad news, depending on who
you are. If there's a mandate, it's amazing how much you can get done.
True. Especially if it has a bit of, you know, and you'll be fined, blah, million per day you're not in compliance. If there's something like that behind it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of cutesy names, Poodle. It's back.
Well, no, we're done with Poodle. I don't want to do Poodle again.
Well, you and I are probably done with Poodle. Because the changes that we need are done. But unfortunately, a whole bunch of website administrators are not done with it. And there's something really weird here. So normally, when there's a vulnerability, it's the small sites are the most vulnerable. They don't have professional sysadmins. They're just sitting on a server somewhere. In this case, it's the people who spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on giant big iron load balancers are vulnerable, and people running their own Apache web servers are not.
Hmm.
Completely on its head. which it has the advantage that the people who have work to do are exactly the people who have the resources to do the work. So this should be fixed way quicker than Poodle 1.
Okay, good. So norms so like us don't have to worry.
No, so real Poodle, as we'll call it, is a problem with SSL version 3. And the reason that's affecting us as end users is that our browser manufacturers have just sent us a whole bunch of updates disabling SSL version 3 in our browsers, which protects us. What's going on here is that TLS version 1, which replaced SSL version 3, has new security features which make Poodle impossible, but some people implemented the good standard badly. And so the fix, so there's nothing wrong with TLS 1, it's some people's implementation of TLS 1 is broken. And those people are massive corporations that make these really expensive devices that large websites use.
Okay.
They've issued patches. They had patches out very quickly. So no need to panic. So basically the reason I'm mentioning this is because I know there are headlines saying Poodle's back and people are going to be panicking.
Don't panic.
Don't panic.
Okay, good. So we'll move on to something else we can worry about.
The next story is one I want to put in just because I think people should be aware that this is going on and because I want to wholeheartedly 110% support Microsoft.
Okay.
So there is a court case where an American court has ordered Microsoft to hand over stuff in its Dublin, Ireland data center.
Oh, we've talked about this already.
We have. This keeps dragging on. Microsoft have filed another document in the case and they have asked the very same question. What would you think, Mr. Judge, if this was the other way around and a German court insisted that a New York data center be subject to German law?
Sure. Or let's make it a little more interesting. Let's say it was China.
Right. So
we might give the Germans something, but we wouldn't give the Chinese, right?
I don't think an American court would be inclined to give any foreign jurisdiction.
It just makes it sound that much more alarming and inflammatory, right?
That is true. So basically, as an Irish person, I feel very strongly that the sovereignty of my nation is being challenged by this. And I think it's hubristic in the extreme of American courts to think they rule me, which is a very personal reaction, right?
Right.
But on a practical reaction, if the cloud is to succeed as a business model, this court case has to fail.
Yeah,
Microsoft has to win this. Because Irish institutions, European institutions, will not tolerate CIA spying on all of our stuff.
Sure. So the thing that I find, well, I don't know why you brought the CIA up into that, but
NSA, one of those three letters.
No, but that isn't. That could be extrapolated, but that is not the topic of this.
Okay, but FISA courts come into this, right? If we're under American jurisdiction, the FISA court can order the stuff to be handed over, which is those secret courts.
But you don't even have to go that far for this just to be completely wrong. You don't have to bring out the conspiracy bad government stuff. You can just say, you don't have a right to look at my stuff. It's not there. It's here. It's our law. I mean, it could be, you know, Bank of America wanting to look at it and it's just as wrong.
No, absolutely. But I think in the post-Snowden world, we're extra sensitive.
Yeah, but I want to stay away from that topic because I'm tired of that topic. But to me, this adds to the Snowden thing in that it would make another reason no country would ever do business with us. So this could, apart from the impact that would never happen to you because you guys won't allow it, it actually could destroy the economy of the United States if they did this. I mean, it's crippling to us.
The argument from the judge is that an American corporation has control, and all that matters is control. It doesn't matter what country it's in. If you have control and you're an American company, the American courts can tell you what to do. And the outcome of that, if that stands, will be that Europeans will not do business with American cloud providers.
I'm curious to see, I would be curious to have somebody walk through exactly the procedure that would happen. So let's say the court says it's legal, Microsoft, you have to give this stuff up. On that day, the Irish police walk into the offices of Amazon and close their doors, right? Unplug their Ethernet cable and tell them you're out. What would that scenario look like? I think that would be interesting.
I don't know, but I imagine the first round of that scenario would be an awful lot of hot air coming out of the European Commission, whose heads would explode collectively.
But that would not be very effective because the information would depart before they got to it.
What would then start to happen is that there will be a pushback. So like when Putin invaded Ukraine. We didn't march in there and kick him out. We said, okay, fine, we're going to sanction your banks. So what I would imagine is, okay, so right now we have a treaty with you on copyright. Yeah, we don't have that treaty anymore.
That, jeez. Well, that's stupid. I would march in with the police. And just say, this is now an illegal organization. You're out, you know? But anyway.
That probably is harder to do.
Yeah, but it'd be
diplomatic
fun.
Stuff is easier to do in a strange, perverted way. Let's hope it doesn't happen.
Yeah. In other news, I don't have my source on this, but I heard that a bunch of the big tech companies are backing Microsoft in this, like Apple and a bunch of other companies, but not Google, interestingly enough.
I didn't notice the absence.
Yeah, I should try to come up with a list, but I heard that Google was oddly absent when everybody, I mean, Salesforce, everybody was on.
Because I've seen a list with lots of big names, but I didn't specifically look for Google, so I don't know if I saw it or not.
Yeah, I'm going to try to find it while we're chatting.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, I'll give people a quick PSA, or public service announcement. If you have two-factor auth enabled on iCloud, don't lose the recovery key, because if you do, you may never get your data back. End of PSA.
That seems obvious, though, doesn't it?
It's pretty obvious, but apparently it was a big news thing and a scandal, so I thought we'd mention it. Also, attention WordPress bloggers, 100,000 WordPress sites are currently infected and spreading malware because of a vulnerability in a plugin called RevSlider. If it's you, fix yourself. If you don't have that plugin, you're fine.
Okay.
Attention developers, there is a critical bug in Git that has just been patched. If you use Git, patch yourself. You're a developer, you know how to.
Okay.
That's it. So they're all the big news stories, apart from
the biggest of the big.
The interview in the room, the interviewing elephant, whatever we'll call it. Sony.
Yeah.
When was the last time we recorded? It's about 2 weeks ago, right? Because we're pre-recording this on the Monday before people are going to hear it. So maybe God knows what's happened between the 22nd of December?
Yeah.
And whenever people hear this. But as of now, everything that's happened since the last time we spoke is as follows. A whole bunch of security experts have weighed in and basically said, yeah, Sony can say that anyone would have felt this hack, but honestly, you were more vulnerable because you were really bad at security, and hacks aren't binary things. It's not that either you're completely owned or you're not owned at all. Your security determines how owned you are, and your security was so bad that you're very owned. And, you know, stop making excuses. You were bad.
Now, was part of that that I heard that they were audited like shortly or a few months before this happened, and they identified a bunch of areas that were not being audited that they felt had holes in them. And they pointed, I think it was PricewaterhouseCoopers that had done the audit. And they're like, here, 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 and here. You're not watching that.
I didn't read that exact story, but it sounds entirely in keeping with the kinds of things ex-employees are saying.
Well, they did have 11 people working security, 7 of whom were managers.
Oh, Jesus.
Seriously. It's a 6,000-person company, you know, that piece of the company.
So if there's 11 of them, and how many were managers?
7.
That means 7 people managing 4 people. What?
Yes. I don't find that shocking from my personal experience.
I do. I'm delighted to say I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, that's not good. Also in the not good column, the hackers, of course, had access to everything they wanted, which includes the private keys for digital certificates. So shock and or horror, very quickly there was malware surfacing signed by Sony. So we'll need some OS updates to remove trust of those certificates, shall we say.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, but of course, if you get everything, well, you get everything.
Yeah.
Sony decided that the best thing to do here is to try muzzle the press, so they sent out lovely letters to reporters like Brian Krebs telling him to stop reporting on this. Oh, joy.
Oh.
The GOP, which is not the grand old party, that is the Guardians of the Peace, as these hackers have called themselves. I have to wonder if they chose that name on purpose.
Yeah, it is kind of funny, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, even in Europe, we know what the GOP is. Mm-hmm. Although I think most of my compatriots don't know it's grand old party. They think it's the Republicans, but that they can't spell. But either way, anyway, the GOP, that's not the Republicans, have taken things, or they took things up a notch, and they threatened 9/11 style terror at cinemas. Yay.
Right.
Sony responded to this bluster by cancelling the movie. Oh. President Obama responded by criticising Sony for giving in to the terrorists. especially when these national security people were saying, there's no credible here, folks. These people are just spewing hot air. This was then followed by the FBI officially blaming North Korea. So where we are now is that officially America say it was the Koreans. So that's no longer speculation. That is now the official policy of the United States of America.
But they say, huh-uh.
Of course they say, ha-ha, because the Americans have promised that there will be reprisals.
No, no, the North Koreans say, huh-uh. They say, no, we didn't.
I know.
It isn't us.
Of course, because, well, the Americans said that there will be consequences. And I don't think they want those.
Oh, okay.
And then the last development is that the GOP very kindly said that Sony can release a movie after all if they just make a few edits, particularly the bit where they kill Kim Jong-il or Kim Jong-un or whichever one of them it was.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, so this is a cluster. Basically, there are links in the show notes to all of this if people care to dig in more. This is the story that's going to keep on giving for quite some time.
Now, one of the things that worried me when is part of what they found when they dug around was they found unencrypted password lists. Mm-hmm. And I have personal experience working for a company that wouldn't let us use LastPass because they thought that it had to be insecure and thought it was better that everybody have to remember every password that they had to change, you know, every 30, 60, 90 days and that kind of thing. You know, they implemented policies on changing your password, but they never let us use anything that allowed us to store those passwords.
Well, but, I mean, surely you're all superhuman, right?
There's that.
I mean, if the policy is written with the assumption that you're superhuman, then you just have to become better, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's I see this over and over again where good and well-intentioned things have really negative side effects. Forcing people to change their password often results in post-it notes on monitors.
Right.
You
put them under the keyboard.
I was going to say you ban them because the manager walks by and sees them. So then they end up upside down under the keyboard.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And then if you check there, they'll be under the mouse mat. Right? They're not going away because humans cannot remember ever-changing passwords. They are going to be written down.
I think they said you could write them down on a piece of paper as long as you locked them in a cabinet with a key. So, good morning. It's time to log into your email. Go unlock your cabinet, pull out the paper, type it in, put it back in the cabinet. Lock. Yeah, right.
Okay. I have recently had to pop a couple of cabinets because someone lost their keys. They're not hard to get into.
There you go.
Very small amount of BFI will open those right up.
By the way, I just found a link to an article, a PDF by Microsoft. I'll give you the link that shows the list of the 28 companies who have written the brief supporting Microsoft. Excellent. And Google's not on there.
Less excellent.
Yeah. A lot of odd companies too, like the Daily Beast, NPR. Scripps.
Well, NPR, I guess, would come at it from a public interest point of view.
Sure, but some of these other Scripps, that's a medical thing.
Are they probably a multinational company?
I don't know. It's a doctor's. It's hospitals research. There's also.
I imagine they're very sensitive to data protection.
Yeah. There's also a whole bunch of trade associations and advocacy associations, a bunch of professors of computer science, and one professor of international law supporting them.
Well, that's good, especially the latter guy. He might be useful.
Yeah, or she.
Or she. So that is where we stand in the world of Sony. Then the other annoying... Actually, here's a specific question to listeners. Notable breaches. These used to be rare, and now every week there's loads of them. Do we keep doing this? Listing all the companies who've got it wrong. Which this week is Staples, ICANN, Park and Fly, Delta Airlines, and Charge Anywhere.
Nice.
So maybe we just tell people to read the links if they're affected. Maybe we should give the names so people know whether or not they need to read the story. Maybe that's the answer.
Yeah, yeah, just a listing of the stories.
So I'm afraid the Staples one is the one that jumps out at me there as being Auga, Auga. That was a breach from April to September affecting 1.16 million credit cards. Sorry, credit and debit, so cards.
You know, that I'm afraid has just started to sound like noise.
It has, hasn't it? It's actually, there's a story in suggested reading I'm just going to highlight here because I think it just made me laugh so much. Someone did a security company did a survey of retailers and found that they are predominantly overconfident in their security abilities. Duh. See previous list.
Right.
So really, suggested reading, I want to draw people's attention that they may be interested. The Dutch government are having a go at Facebook and Google, not perhaps in the way we'd expect. What they're saying is, we don't like what you're doing because you're not giving people clear, you're not asking for clear enough consent. You must ask for unambiguous consent before you do what you're doing, which is an interesting approach to take. So they're not saying don't do it. They're saying be more honest, or rather be more open rather than be more honest.
Yeah.
And since we're talking about Sony, I thought it was also worth mentioning that a German steel factory had some rather expensive furnaces physically damaged by a malware attack. And a casino was very badly hit by Iranian attackers using VB script, of all things.
Jeez.
So this kind of damaging corporate attack is not just happening to Sony. And
nothing
other than
like
that,
Sony's, though.
Right. But again, I think that shows that how weak you are once you get into the perimeter makes a difference. Right? Once you're through the shell, how wide open is everything when you're in?
Yeah, that's actually a good point.
You know, because and the old-fashioned model was you protect the you protect your perimeter, you put all your resources there, and then you don't worry about the rest. And that's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. You want defense in depth. Anyway, there's a few other stories there if people want to catch them. It's pretty much all bad news, actually. So if you want to be in a good mood, just don't read them.
Okay. Okay. Can we go play now?
Yes, please.
All right. So we are.
Close my tab. Give me a second.
There you go. Yes. Just make it go away.
Okay.
Taming the Terminal, part 26 of N.
Yes, and something really weird has happened to my computer.
Uh-oh.
Although, okay. View. How do I... Actual size. Okay. Somehow, I guess I held something down while I scrolled, but suddenly the text was like 500 point.
Oh, nice. I think Command 0 gets you back.
It does, actually, or the menu is view actual size. So I'm back to normal now. It's all good. It's all good. Okay.
I do that to Steve all the time because I can't see. I go in his office and I change the size of the viewing. And then he's like, what did you do?
It is a bit weird. The fact that it remembers from page to page is freaky.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Taming the Terminal. We're on part 26 of N. And I'm going to keep it a lowercase n no matter what Steve says. that's a little in-joke there. Sorry. Okay, so... Just a reminder, we are making our way through the TCP/IP networking stack. So just a reminder that that's a four-layer thing, a link layer at the bottom. Computers send one packet on the local network, then the internet layer, one packet across multiple networks, then the transport layer, a stream of meaningful data across multiple networks, and then finally the application layer, which is where all of our networky protocols that we actually use, like our web browsers, our email clients live. So far in our story, we had a good long chat about Ethernet, and then we had a very long chat about IP.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that chat, we described the settings you need to make IP go, and we sort of didn't really mention how they came to be. I think we may have vaguely mentioned that there was a thing called the HTTP, but we'll talk about that some other time.
Right.
So we want to fill that in because I don't like leaving stuff as magic. And you did a really good job actually explaining the big picture in the post show. But just to reinforce that idea, two shows from now. So this is part 26. So not part 27, but part 28. We're going to have an episode that I think everyone is going to want to bookmark because we're going to create a toolkit for troubleshooting network problems. And we'll be able to do that because we will know what everything is.
Okay.
So we're building towards a list of terminal commands that you can use to figure out why your network isn't working.
Oh, goody. Because to be honest, while I learned a lot last time, we haven't gotten to actually touch the terminal in a little while.
We haven't. And the reason is because networking terminal commands don't make any sense until you know what you're tinkering with. Just like we had to do a deep dive in the file system before we did the file system commands.
Right.
The problem is the network is so much bigger than the file system. The deep dive is taking us a little while.
Okay.
But we are going to come back up and end up with command. So I may as well give you the big picture now. So we've done Ethernet, we've done IP. Today we're going to do the HTTP, and then the next time we're going to do DNS. Because you can have a fully functional IP network, and if your DNS is broken, it will seem as if your network's broken.
Hmm. Okay.
Because you'll type something in a browser and nothing will happen.
Right.
So when we have those pieces in place, we can then do a sort of an A to Z. Okay, someone has handed me a computer, it's not working on the network. Where to start, next, and sort of work your way through with terminal commands to figure out what's going on. So today is DHCP day. And in very
happy little, HEP day.
Well, I think every day is actually.
You live in a magical world, Bart.
Well, we do, and we should be thankful, right? Because if we rewind the clock, there used to be a time when that wasn't the case. And I vividly remember the first time I tried to set up a home network. I bought network cards, which I had to install myself, and I plugged in network cables, and then I scratched my head for a very long time and gave up.
Aww.
Because back in the old days, you had to manually configure the three network settings we ended up talking about. So at the end of last week, we said that in order for your computer to work on the network, it had to have an IP, a subnet mask, and a default gateway. And unless you understand how all that works, you can't magic those numbers out of your head. And so I had these boxes to fill in as a 12-year-old. I didn't know what to put in, so I just made them up. 0.0.0.1, 0.0.0.2. That should be fine. No, it wasn't. Anyway, so historically, of course, devices didn't really move, right? So yeah, you had to configure them manually, but they didn't move. So okay, it was an annoyance once, but then you were done. So you'd get a new computer, you'd plug it in, you'd set up his network details once, and that would be that. So if you're in a corporate environment, the network guy would come by, plumb you in, type a few settings, and that would be the last anything had to be done to your computer for the next 5 or 10 years. Then we developed mobile, portable computers. And that system became really quite troublesome. Because imagine every time you brought your laptop somewhere else, you had to manually change the network settings.
Jeez.
Firstly, we'd have to remember them. And then we'd have to change them every time, assuming we remembered them.
I do remember having to change some stuff, like when you went to work versus home, you had to set up these sort of profiles where you would switch, but you didn't have to type anything in by hand.
Right, so profiles are one way of attacking that problem. So the original problem was that you didn't have profiles and you had to type it in. And so the quick fix by the Microsofts and the Apples was to add this concept of profiles into the operating system so it could remember multiple network settings and you'd have to change which setting was current.
Mm-hmm.
Which is still doing manual configuration, but at least it's a bit less painful.
Right, right.
But, you know, that solution just gets worse and worse and worse and worse because on your average day with your iPhone, you could easily use 10 or 20 networks if you're walking around in a big city. Easily.
Oh, right.
So that just wouldn't scale over a week, a month, a year. You couldn't have a profile for every Starbucks you've ever been in, a profile for every Apple store you've been in, a profile for every office you've ever visited. Do your head in. So the solution was to come up with a protocol that would allow computers to discover the settings themselves. So you would plug them in, they would ask the network, how should I be configured? And the network would tell them, which sounds like a very good idea. And this is not a new idea. This idea dates all the way back to the 80s, to 1984, in fact. The first attempt at doing this was something called RARP, or reverse ARP. So we learned a few installments ago that ARP is a way of figuring out what IP address matches a MAC address, and someone thought, well, what if we could do it the other way around? Given our MAC address, figure out what our IP address should be, then we could configure ourselves. So they came up with RARP.
Reverse ARP?
Reverse ARP, right. Okay. Sounds clever. Not a bad first attempt. It had a few flaws, chiefly among which it was designed. It worked over layer one, which meant that the server had to be on the same network as all the clients. And so if you were a company with 20 different networks, you had 20 different RARP servers. That's a bit of a pain in the backside. So a whopping 1 year later, RARP was replaced.
Wow.
Yeah. Didn't take them long to realize that was a whoopsie. So BootP is the next one, or the Bootstrap protocol is its full name. And BootP was the same sort of idea, but it changed it a bit. And BootP introduced this concept of a relay agent where you could have a little relay agent in every network and you could have one central server managing all of your networks, which is a definite step towards where we want to be. But BootP still had its brain in the past. So BootP was living in the world where you plugged the device in once, it got its settings, and they never changed. So BootP just automated that sort of paradigm. So a BootP server would hand an IP address to a MAC address, and it would be that IP would belong to that MAC address forever. So imagine if your Starbucks worked like that. They'd run out of IP addresses by lunchtime. No, not by lunchtime, by 9 a.m.
Really, really.
Yeah, on the first day. So that obviously is not going to work. So in 1993, we got the protocol we have today. And in fact, DHCP is an extension of BootP. It's the same basic design, but with some extra features added on. And the most important of those extra features is a change of philosophy. So DHCP doesn't give an IP address to a MAC address. It leases an IP address to a MAC address. So you rent an IP address. So you walk into Starbucks, you ask it for an IP address. It says, sure, this one's yours for an hour. Or this one's yours for 8 hours, depending on how the server is configured. And then once that time is up, you have to ask for another one. Or ask for an extension. Can I have a bit more time with this IP address? Oh, well, right, you're still here. Fine, have it. And that is actually the model we use today. So DHCP from 1993 is still what we use today. Now, we have a chicken and egg situation, and I may just make your head explode here. So DHCP is a layer 4 protocol. It's an application layer protocol that uses UDP to configure IP.
Okay. I've heard all those words.
Okay, so I've told you that UDP uses IP. So the application layer uses either UDP or TCP, and UDP or TCP use IP, and IP uses Ethernet. So how can something that depends on IP be used to configure IP? That is a real chicken and egg, right?
You did lose me. You know that, right?
Okay, so if you want to send a UDP packet, UDP uses IP to send its packets.
Uh-huh.
DHCP uses UDP to do its magic. But its purpose in life is to configure IP.
But you don't have IP yet.
Yeah.
Because you haven't asked for... Okay, I got you. Yeah. We're in a circle there.
Right?
Okay,
I got
you.
We're in a bit of a chicken and egg situation. You might ask yourself, but how is this possible? And it is possible. This is good news. Well, we know it's possible. It works every day. The reason it's possible is because even if you don't know what your IP address is, and you don't know what your netmask is, and you don't know where your router is, you can still send one very special type of IP packet. You can send a broadcast. You can send a packet to the address 255.255.255.255.
You told us that last week, that there was that broadcast.
There was this IP. Magic universal broadcast, yeah.
Okay.
So this is not a broadcast within a subnet. This is just a screaming out to the whole planet. So the ARP protocol takes that IP address of all 255s and translates it to the magical MAC address of all Fs, which means every single network card that can hear me, listen. So DHCP uses this in order to be able to talk on the network before it has an IP address. It just shouts to the whole network, hello, help me!
Okay.
And in fact, the DHCP server has to shout back because there is no IP address for it to actually talk to, so everything in DHCP is shouty. So we're using these broadcasts to get around the fact that we don't have an IP address yet. And that's how we make the chicken and egg problem go away.
Okay.
So for this to work, one of two things has to be true. So you wander in into Starbucks or whatever, you turn on Wi-Fi or you shove an Ethernet cable into the side of your laptop. If you are going to successfully get an answer from DHCP, one of two things has to be true. Thing one is that there's a DHCP server on your network that can hear you shout for help. Or thing two is that there's this thing called a DHCP relay agent sitting on your network that can help you to get help. Now, in our home networks, we have these magical boxes called home routers.
Yes?
Okay, sorry, I thought you were gone for a sec.
No.
And as you... was it you or was it Jim Davidson or was it someone in the comments, I should have remembered who, said to be sure to point out that a home router is not a router.
Steve Davidson.
Lots of parts. Steve Davidson. So just to remind you again that your home router is this magical box of lots of different parts. And we know three of those parts already. We know it has a router part, an Ethernet switch part, and a wireless access point part. Well, I can tell you it has a fourth part.
Oh?
It is also a DHCP server.
Okay.
So within our house, there is a DHCP server on our network.
Right.
When we go to work or to our university or whatever, that's not true. We don't have home routers lying around the office. So all I'm going to say is that if you buy one of those really expensive switches from Cisco that cost a house payment, they have a DHCP agent built into them. And so the way companies and universities work is that every network has an agent, and all of those agents talk back to one centralized pool of DHCP servers that serve all those networks.
Okay.
But that's beyond the scope of this discussion. So I am telling you that DHCP relay agents exist. We're not going to talk about them.
Okay. All right.
Right. Corporations couldn't work without them, but we don't need to talk about them because we're focused on home users. So for us, it is true that there is a DHCP server listening on our network. It is one of the things our home router does for us. So how does it work? You shove in the cable. Well, assuming everything goes to plan and there's nothing broken, there is a four-way, I'm not sure if you quite call it a four-way handshake because they're not four people shaking hands, but it's basically a four-word conversation is had. And if so, you should always see the sequence. The client starts by shouting out to that magical all 255's IP address what's called the DHCP discover packet, which is basically a cry for help. I am this MAC address and I would like an IP address, please. And it just shouts that out to the whole network. The HTTP server hears that and it responds with a second packet called the DHCP offer. And the DHCP offer basically says, how about this one? Assuming the client is happy, it then receives that offer and responds with a request, which is basically saying, okay, great, I'll take that. And then there's one final answer from the server saying, okay, it's yours.
Why would the client not accept it? What would be a reason it wouldn't want it?
Maybe the client insists that it has to know some information and the server responds back and says, I can offer you an IP address, but I have no idea what your subnet mask should be. The client may just decide to say, I won't bother, so you're not a good enough network to deal with. Right? It's okay. Up to the client to decide whether or not it's happy. In reality, right? In reality, all these four steps just go bing, 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 bing. So what you should see on a healthy network is discover, offer, request, ACK. And you should get that into your head because if you're ever troubleshooting, the thing you want to see, and I'll show you how to see it in a minute, but the thing you want to see is discover, offer, request, ACK. Discover, offer, request, ACK. That is a healthy network.
What's ACK?
ACK is the acknowledgement. So that is the server saying, okay.
ACK is acknowledgement.
Yes, it's a common shorthand in networking, actually, is ACK, is for acknowledge.
Okay. Now, this may throw a monkey work in here, and tell me if you don't want to go down this this
please.
Path here, but I've been on networks shortly after DHCP was put in place. We had static IPs everywhere, and after DHCP was put in place, I know it used to happen where you'd be working along, and all of a sudden a notification would pop up on screen saying, hey, somebody else has this IP address, you can't use it anymore.
That is probably not a DHCP problem, but a coworker problem.
So someone trying to put in a static IP that happened to be the one that you got?
So in other words, if someone is hard coding, just picking a random address and hard coding it into their computer, they will do that to you. And that is the bane of my life and work, is people hard coding IP addresses.
Okay.
Dear people, don't do that. I don't think anyone is listening who actually does that, you know, who actually is on my work network. But anyway, dear people, don't
just
do that.
Just in case.
There's another sysadmin somewhere else on the planet is thankful I said that.
Right. Somebody listening is doing that to some other sysadmin. Okay.
Yes. So on a DHCP network, don't do that. Don't be that guy.
Okay.
Or that gal. So let's look at those in just a little bit more detail. So remember, though, if you remember nothing else from today, that sequence of four is good. That is the single most important takeaway from everything we say today. Because when you're troubleshooting, if you don't see that order, problem. And in fact, if the problem is DHCP, that means go look at your router. That means the problem is there. So discover, offer, request, ACK. Okay, so what's in those packets? It's probably let's look in more detail. So the discover says, I am this MAC address. I am looking for network configurations. I would like to have, and it lists all of the things it wants to know. So at the very least, I'd like an IP address. I'd like a net mask. I'd like a router address. I'd like a DNS server is probably also in there. It may even, if you're a Windows machine, say, I'd like a WINS server, which is a nasty, horrible thing used for NetBIOS names in Windows networking.
So wait a minute. If my machine requests a netmask and an IP address, why does it need a network address too? Isn't it defined by those two?
No, not network address, gateway.
Okay. See, so I was paying attention.
Good, great. No, fantastic. That's a really good question. Makes me very happy. So the discover is saying who is discovering and what they're looking for. The discover also contains something which is literally, and I'm not making this up, it is actually in the raw packet called a magic cookie.
Okay.
It's not really magic. It's a random number picked by the client. And it is literally used so that on a real network, there are a lot of DHCP requests going on. One of the things I do in work is manage our DHCP cluster, and there are literally hundreds of requests a minute.
Wow.
If not 100, but 700 or 800.
Okay.
If there wasn't this little magic cookie, how would the machine who made asked the question know which answer was for it? Because they're all being shouted, remember? Everything is being shouted.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So it's basically a little tag. It's like putting a ribbon on your suitcase. So you pick a magic cookie and stick it into your packet, and when the server answers you, he'll give you back that cookie. Therefore, you'll know the answer's for you. And if the cookie is different, it's for some other guy who's looking for something as well. So that's all the magic cookie is. It's not okay. Magic. It's just a unique identifier that you pick.
Okay.
The server then answers with its offer, and in its offer, it actually gives you pretty much everything you would need to come onto the internet, except for permission.
Oh, okay.
So it answers with, here's an IP address I have on offer. It goes with this Mac, it goes with this Netmask, it goes with this router address, it goes with this DNS server, it goes with this WIN server. My IP address is this, and, you know, probably some other information too. And it also says, and I'm offering this to you for blah amount of time. So it will tell the client what lease is on offer. Oh. The client will then reply with its request saying, yes, do please give me that. And just as a reminder, here's what I'd like. And the client can also ask for a longer lease, which the server may or may not acquiesce to.
So a server the lease is by important. Me, will not, so by the server needs that lease time because it's getting hundreds of requests mm-hmm. per minute. It needs to be able to release that to give it to somebody else.
Yes, so when you leave, so imagine you come into Starbucks for 5 minutes. If it gave you a 24-hour lease, that IP address would be locked up for 24 hours.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought this was just until you accepted that this was this lease time. You mean how long it gets to keep it all together.
Yes, correct. So the lease time is the length of time you rent. So I'm looking to rent, basically, think of it like renting a hotel room. I'd like a room for 2 days. And the hotel may come back and say, sorry, but we only have it for 1 day.
So in a company with a lot of, you know, PCs plugged into walls that are not laptops, a long lease time could be months.
I've never seen them quite that long because it means you can't change the network. So one of the joys of DHCP is that if you need to come in on a Saturday, completely rearrange the network, you don't have to reconfigure a single PC as long as you update the DHCP server. And then the next morning, everyone comes in, turns on their computer. They get the new network details from the DHCP server and no one realizes that you've completely re-architected everything.
Oh, okay.
So you don't want them too long or you tie your own hands.
Right.
So to give you an idea, actually real-world idea, right? So you don't have to give the same lease on every subnet. So if you have one server managing 10 networks, you can give a long lease on 9 of them and a short lease on the 10th. So a real-world scenario, an office environment, desktop PCs, a day is normal. And that means that in the morning, your server has a lot of work to do, give everyone an IP address for the day, and it can fall over in a heap at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it doesn't matter at all. You have hours to fix it because no one really needs a lease again until the morning.
Okay.
We also have a network. It's a really cool thing. It's called EduRoam. I think it's becoming popular in America too. It's this wireless network that every student from every participating institution can use on any institution.
Wait, so now you're into permissions, though. That's a separate
topic.
Okay,
you are. But the reason I'm saying this is because it is a busy network, right? Every single student who is one of ours is allowed to use EduRoam, and every visitor from another university is also allowed to use EduRoam. So the EduRoam network is busy.
Okay.
That means there's a lot of people coming and going. And in fact, one person equals about 3 IP addresses these days. One for their iPhone, one for their iPad, one for their laptop. Right? Really busy. So they have a lease time of just 30 minutes.
So after 30 minutes, it doesn't mean that your IP address changes. It just means that it's allowed to change.
Correct. It means you have to ask again. Can I still use this? And the server will say, yeah, you're good for 30 more minutes. Can I still use this? Have 30 more.
Oh, okay.
So it's just, and now it
seems like that would add a lot of network traffic too.
It does. No, it does. It does. But it frees up IP addresses. And in the modern world where IPv4 addresses are sparse, that matters.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
It really matters. Okay, so that's the lease. Very important. So the client, having been offered some settings, the client replies back and says, okay, give them to me. And then the server answers one last time saying, okay, it's yours for this long. And just as a reminder, here's those settings you asked for again.
Oh, good.
And that's it then. At that point, once you have received the ACK, you have permission to use those settings. So your computer will apply them, and then you'll see the little blinky bars in your Wi-Fi icon stop blinking and go solid. Or if you're looking in the network system preferences, the orange light will go green. So red means off, orange means I'm in the middle of my DHCP negotiation, green means I'm done. So did you ever notice those traffic lights when you're looking in the OS 10 system preference?
Well, yeah, that's what they mean. Stuff's not working.
Right, if DHCP never answers because it's broken, it'll never go green.
And I've seen that.
You'll never have an IP address. Yeah.
Or, well, if you get a 169, does it turn green?
No, because that's not from the ATP. That's a self-signed.
Okay.
So it will stay. It will say orange because something isn't right.
Right, right.
Now, this just wouldn't be taming the terminal if I didn't show you. So I've told you.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to show you. So there is a terminal command that I'd like you to copy and paste. Now we will, I promise, do a full show on TCP dump in the future. But for today, I would just like you to copy paste.
Now, you told me before the show that you wanted me to do this on another computer. Do I need to start the other computer now or start or just use the one I'm using for the call?
I would suggest... Okay, so you can leave this running on your current computer and it will just watch your network for all of those shouty traffic. And assuming that there's a Roku somewhere in your house that happens to ask for an IP while we're recording, you'll see it. But if you want to make it happen, the easiest way to make it happen is to turn Wi-Fi on and off. And I'd prefer you do that on a computer that's not the one you're talking to me on.
All right. So do you want to tell people what I just typed in?
Okay. So it's sudo because you have to be root to do TCP dump. So sudo TCP dump space minus ENNV. We'll talk about why in a future show. Space port 67 space or space port 68.
Okay.
And those are the two ports that that DHCP uses, by the way, 67 and 68. So that is just going to print on screen every DHCP packet that flies by your computer. And it's going to give them to you in great detail. Everything in that packet will be printed. So the way you interpret this is if the text starts on the first column, it is a new packet, and then everything inside that packet is tabbed in. So it starts on the outside, about 15 lines tabbed in, then the next packet will start on the outside, 15 lines tabbed in.
So it's not showing anything right now.
Okay, because that means nothing is happening.
So the 19 devices in my house, none of them have done anything?
Well, how long have you had it running? 30 seconds? Your average lease in your airport is probably in the order of hours.
Okay.
You only have 19 devices.
So they would have to be doing that request thing. I got you.
Yeah, so I mean, if they have a lease and it's not up, they won't do anything, right? They'll just be quiet.
Okay, I just want to make sure it wasn't supposed to be doing it right now.
No. It's just going to show you as they happen. So if you leave that running for an hour, I guarantee you something will happen. But we don't have an error. So you can make it happen.
I just thought of something. Shouldn't I be running this on the computer, the TCP dump on the computer that I am doing the recording on, and the one that's going to go off the network is the other one?
To be honest, you don't have to because the computer that requests, right, as soon as your computer, you'll see your own DHCP packets. So if you're the one requesting,
that's
you'll
what
see
I was them. Wondering. Okay. So I've typed
okay,
it.
So
am I supposed to do something?
If you do that. Now, what I have put into the show notes for people is the copy paste of when I did this earlier before recording.
Okay.
And I have marked in bold all of the things I mentioned that are important.
Magic cookie.
So magic cookie 0x blah, 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 blah. And then you see discover. So DHCP message option 53 linked 1 discover. It means this is a discover packet. So the discover packet you can see there, it has stuff like below that actually parameter request is all of the things I want. I want a subnet mask. I want a default gateway. I want a domain name server. I want a domain name. I want LDAP. I want NetBIOS name server, which is a WINS server, evil things. And then you'll see the next thing to come back is an offer, which has your IP, which is the IP it's offering me, the same magic cookie, and it says it's an offer.
Wait, where does it... offer, the there we go. Yeah, got it. Offer. Right.
The next thing to happen is a request. Oh, I forgot the bold request. Sorry, I need to bold one more line there.
That's close, right?
Same magic cookie request, and this time I've bolded the list of things I want because now we really want them. We're actually requesting it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also saying the IP I'm requesting, which is 192.168.10.206.
Ah.
And the final line is the ACK, where the server has responded with the same magic cookie, with an ACK, and the list of lease times, 7,200 seconds. Which is, who's good at math?
Well,
7,200 seconds, is that?
Divided by 60, it's something more than 10 minutes.
It's more than an
minutes.
Hour. Is it 12 hours? Is that possible?
I don't know.
Anyway, it's a lease time. The important thing is it says subnet mask, 255.255.255.0. Default gateway, 192.168.10.1. Domain name server, 192.168.10.1. Domain name, local domain. So they are all my network settings, and they're exactly what I would see if I went to the network control panel, because that's where they came from. They came from that DHCP response.
So you got this to spit out on your screen by turning Wi-Fi off and back on again?
I had Ethernet, so I plugged the cable out.
So I can do this now?
You should be able to.
Okay, so mine is sitting waiting with that T-speed dump. Mm-hmm. Turn Wi-Fi off. And turn Wi-Fi back on.
Now, it is possible...
And it be dumping.
It be dumping, okay. Now, it's possible you're going to see a shorter version of this, because if your computer has a lease that's still valid, it won't start at Discover. It'll skip over and go straight to Request. And so what you may see is Request did. Act.
Actually, I got Request Act.
That means that your router was slower to respond than your computer felt happy with, and so it just said,
can
hello?
Can I have it? Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Okay, yeah, it looks like it's asking the same question twice.
Yeah, you'll see that from time to time. And you might see multiple offers before your computer gets around to sending back a request.
So, but in my case, I just got request, ACK.
Yes, so your computer had a lease that was still valid, and instead of starting over, it went, do you know something? I'm just going to try my luck and ask for the same one back. And your router went, yeah, okay. I thought you had it anyway. Have it again.
Okay. 400 seconds divided by 60.
So yours is longer than mine. 60.
That's 24 hours.
Which is a sane, it's a sane amount of time, actually. Mine is quite short. I might tweak that. Now, so the four things you want to see are Discover, Offer, Request, ACK. You may see more.
Yeah, yours is only 2 hours.
2 hours? Jesus.
7200 divided by 60 divided by 60 is 2 hours.
That make okay. Well, I'm being very stingy with myself. It does explain why I see a lot of DHCP traffic when I do this. I say a lot.
Can I have it?
Yeah. So we know about the four good ones, right? There are three more types of the HTTP packet you may see. So
Wait a minute, four good ones.
These are the ones I want, right?
These are
the four ones on a healthy network: Discover, Offer, Request, ACK. They make me happy. There's two more actually that are good, but then there's one that's potentially bad. So the other one you might see is Inform. Mm. And that's a way for a DHCP client to ask for more information. And you're unlikely to see this at home. But have you ever noticed in your browser there's a little checkbox saying automatically detect proxy settings?
Right. I used to have to mess with that at work.
What that does is it sends out a DHCP request asking the router or asking the DHCP server, do you happen to know what the proxy server is for this network? And it will then reply and say, why, yes, I do. Or if you're at home, no, I don't. What are you talking about? So that's how proxy auto-configure works with a DHCP inform.
Do you need to tell anybody what proxy servers are? Would that take too long?
If you're in a corporation, you may be unfortunate enough to care.
Okay, let's not care then.
The other one you may see is a really polite one, which is a DHCP release. So if you're doing a control shutdown, you haven't just yanked the cable out, you've gone start shutdown if you're on Windows or click on the Apple shutdown, your computer can let the router know or let the DHCP server know that it's done and it can use that IP address for something else now.
Oh, how polite.
It's very polite, and an awful lot of operating systems don't bother their backside. But it is allowed, and I like when I see it. It's friendly.
I just thought of something. Couldn't I trigger something interesting in this command if I did a release and renew in the network control panel or system preference?
You could. You could ask it to renew the lease by clicking on the button, but you'd probably only see... Well, actually do it and you'll see whether you see 4 or 2.
Well, I could do a release.
If you do a release, then you may actually see one of those nice release
packets. For those following along with the home game, I've opened up system preferences or whatever they call it, settings. Network, clicked on Wi-Fi, advanced, TCP/IP tab. Oh my gosh, is the font messed up. Whoa, it got better. Looks like I just have a renew option.
That's what I thought. Windows has ipconfigure/release and ipconfigure/renew, but I haven't seen that in OS X.
And all I got was a request in ACK.
Yeah, because that's the easiest thing. And your computer will prefer to start with a request because that's just less work. So unless the computer's been off overnight, you're probably going to see just the two.
Oh, okay.
So the first thing I actually did is I started that capture, then I turned on my...
I was doing it with ifconfig. ifconfig /release.
Yeah, that's the Windows, right?
Look at me. Look at me just doing Windows out of my head.
There you go. So the third type of packet, which is not always bad news, but is a sort of prick your eyebrows up packet, is DHCP NAC, which stands for not ACK.
Ooh.
In other words, no, sod off. So there's two possible answers to DHCP request, ACK and NAC. Now, there are innocent reasons a NAC packet can appear. So imagine you turned off your computer. It issued a release because it's friendly, and you turned it back on, and OS X has gone, I'm just going to ask again, just in case it's still free. But Steve has turned on his computer, and he got your IP.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing the server can do then is say, NAC. Sorry, no. You are, sorry, no, can't oblige. What will happen then is your computer will say, discover. You get offered a different IP, you request a different IP, and you'll get a NAC. So perfectly innocent is request NAC, discover, offer, request, ACK.
I actually followed that.
Excellent.
Let me see if I can say it. Let me see if I can ask it. Wait, I always forget the first one's called. It's so not called request. Is it?
Well, usually if you end up with a NAC, you're requesting the IP you had last time on the off chance it's still available. So it would be request.
So it would be request, NAC,
discover.
Offer, or discover, offer,
request,
ACK.
Yes.
Okay.
So request my old IP, be told to shut off, ask for a fresh one. Be offered a fresh one, request the fresh one, acknowledge the fresh one.
I get it.
So that's innocent, right? Perfectly innocent. If you see that on a TCP dump and you're troubleshooting something, not a problem. Don't get worried.
So don't raise your eyebrows or do?
Well, you can put them back down.
Okay, because you understand why it would have happened.
Yeah, so you see a NAC and you go, oh, you wait a second, you go, discover, offer, request, ACK. Okay, fine.
Okay.
Put your eyebrow back there.
Okay.
Another reason it can happen.
This is bothering me a little bit, Bart. I'm following this episode completely.
The HTTP is actually very nice because it's a little conversation going back and forth.
Yeah.
I really like the HTTP.
Yeah.
Another way this can happen is if your network is set up to give out random IP addresses and someone has hard-coded an IP address without it being configured on the
My office mate. Right.
Right. In that case, you ask for an IP, the server offers it to you, you request it. A DHCP server, before it answers a request, will always do a ping. If it gets an answer, it'll say, oops, sorry, can't have that, NAC.
Oh.
Now, if you're using dynamic IP, so random IP addresses, the result of that will be the same as last time. So you'll request the IP, you'll get NAC'd, you'll do a discovery, you'll get offered a different IP, you'll request it, you'll be fine. So that's another innocent way to see a NAC. It's semi-innocent because someone's being naughty, but you got around it.
But tell me, though, in some cases, I may have assigned a static IP, say, to my VPN server inside the house that Donald Burr taught me how to do.
Mm-hmm.
Is the router smart enough to not offer me that one?
It will NAC that one.
Well,
so your DHCP server contains a setting called the range.
Right. And so I have
a list of IP addresses that you have told the router are for it to use for DHCP. You shouldn't put the Donald Burr's server into that range.
Right, that's right. Well, that's why I define the range, is because I want to say, okay, I'm going to do some static IPs in here. I've set a range. Here's where DHCP is. So the DHCP router should never offer me that something outside of the range I've told it.
Correct.
That is what the range means. So you wouldn't be getting a NAC in there. But you're just talking about if now, you know, my buddy Ron comes over and decides to type in a static IP on his machine, that could likely be in the range, and that would get a NAC.
That would get a NAC.
Okay.
Now, where things go wrong is in one of two ways. So that's all innocent, no problem here. But there's two ways this can go wrong. So there is a feature in DHCP servers that you can randomly always give someone the same address, which is called the static lease. So the client is dynamic. It is saying, dear DHCP, tell me what to do. But DHCP is configured to always tell it the same thing. So as a user, it feels like you have a static IP address because it never changes. But it's dynamic because you keep being given it over and over and over again. And this is really useful for home servers because you don't have to actually configure them. You just tell the router to always give the same IP to this guy.
Okay.
And Apple routers can do that, and many, many other brands of router can do it. It's a very useful feature for setting up stuff like your, you know, any sort of home server, like you want to share some files or whatever. It's very useful that they always get the same IP address. I have my desktop machine configured to always get the IP address 42.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a nerd reference.
Of course I do.
Anyway, so where things can go horribly wrong is if you have a client set to always get the same IP and some sod steals that IP, you will never get on the network. Every time you ask, you'll be offered that IP. Every time you request, you'll be NAC'd because it's answering ping. So the only way to fix that is to get the usurper out.
So I missed how you ended up with this static, but not static.
Right. Okay, so I have configured my router so that it's the HTTP server always gives my laptop the IP address 42.
How are you? Isn't that so a static IP?
It's not. Okay.
You said it wasn't.
I'm being very careful with my words
static
here.
Static lease, you said.
It's a static lease because, as far as my computer is concerned, if I look in its configuration, it says use DHCP. Mm. I haven't typed the IP into the computer. So it's not manually configured.
Okay.
But it will always get the same answer from the server because I've told the server this MAC address always gets this IP address.
Okay. So that is the way I defined the server IP address for my when I did the VPN server.
Good.
So that is the Kyle's machine, I have DHCP reservation. That's probably the same thing, right?
That is exactly. That's another name for a static lease is DHCP reservation.
Okay, so Kyle's machine should always be getting, yes, it is getting that. But for, as far as it's concerned, it just says, yep, I'm using DHCP. But the
exactly.
DHCP
so,
serves,
I mean,
so you're yeah, saying so if I came in and typed in 10.0.1.2, which is that what I have in the lease, then that other Mac would never be able to get on because it doesn't know how to ask for something different.
Yes. Or rather, the server keeps telling it the same answer, only there's someone using that IP, so I can't use that
the
IP.
Router's
so we ask the server again. So you ask the DHCP server inside the router, can I have an IP? Have this one. No, I can't use that one. Can I have an IP? Have this one. But I can't use that one. Have an IP. And you have an infinite loop here until you find the naughty person and plug their Ethernet cable out or turn off their Wi-Fi. Then you'll be offered it, and then you can take it. So that's a way that you can see NACs, and it's bad. And you'll see that there's something wrong because I can't get on the internet. Why can't I get on the internet? You'll do this TCP dump command and you'll see NAC, NAC, NAC. Oh, sugar. Okay, someone has my IP. Great.
So now this is an important distinction because we said that if you're doing a static IP, you would want to make sure that the DHCP server knows to only serve out from a range that does not include that address. But in this case, the DHCP reservation or lease is in the range of DHCP addresses.
It doesn't have to be. It depends on your router. So the DHCP protocol allows the statically assigned, the reservations to be outside the range.
Okay.
So when I
configure
I did
it inside the range.
It's okay because the server knows. As long as it's all done within the DHCP server, it knows what you mean and it's perfectly happy. It won't do anything silly because it knows.
Yeah, the person most likely to screw this up is me, is to go, hey, I think I'm going to type in a static IP over here.
Yes. And the nice thing actually about doing them as reservations is the GUI in your router won't let you type in something illegal.
Mm.
So it will check you. Whereas if you're typing it in on the actual computer, the computer will let you do all sorts of daft things. The router, the DHCP server, is smart. It won't let you type in something that's outside the netmask or whatever. It won't let you do illegal stuff, which is very useful.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so actually, I've just realized I have to find some electricity within the next very shortly. No, I have 12%. Okay, I'm looking around the room. I'll find the moment to sneak away.
Okay.
So the last thing that can cause NACs to go absolutely ballistic is if there's two DHCP servers. They can end up fighting with each other. And if a server sees an ACK going out that it doesn't agree with, it will send the NAC to slap it back down. And so if you have two DHCP servers plugged into the same network and one guy says, you can have that IP, the other guy says, no, you can't. You can have this one. And then the first guy says, no, you can't. What you will see is these ACK-NAC, 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 ACK-NAC. And they will just do it forever and no one will get on the network.
That's nice.
This can happen by accident or because someone is being malicious.
Ah.
So if you see ACK-NAC, 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 you will probably notice that the from address in the packets is two different IP addresses, i.e. two different DHCP servers having a fight. One of them shouldn't be there. Find it and turn it off.
So there just shouldn't be two of them.
Which could be that you bought a wireless extender, which also has a DHCP server built in.
We're back to that again.
It on. Yeah. Remember, a home router is this box of things we can turn on and off. If you turn the DHCP bit on in two places and you have it configured so that it's one Ethernet network, problem. So if you turn the router bit off and the DHCP bit on, problem. If you turn the router bit on, you've now got two subnets. So you need a second DHCP server, so that's okay, but you have two subnets. So how you turn things on or off can make different problems. But one problem you can have is two DHCP servers.
Interesting.
And that's bad.
And then you get
always ACK-NAC. ACK-NAC, ACK-NAC if they start having a fight with each other. Sometimes they'll coexist peacefully. But you will see extra NACs because this guy will offer something and accidentally stumble on someone else's and then randomly pick a different IP that's free. So they can live in semi-harmony, or they can have a complete and utter fight with each other and just stop everyone using your network.
Yeesh.
So ACNAC is very bad if you see that happening over, you know, one after the other, one after the other, one after the other. It's a very obvious pattern when you see it, and that's what it is. And I have seen it happen on actual networks with hundreds of clients and no one being able to access the internet out of hundreds of people. It's made for a bad morning, actually.
Okay.
So that is actually all there is to the protocol, but I have a terminal command I'd like to share with you before we go home.
Yay! Which computer do I want to be on?
It doesn't really matter. Actually, just in case you type some of these commands, maybe stay on the one you're not recording on.
Okay.
So you were looking at the OS X network GUI there.
Right.
There is a terminal command that's OS X specific that can do everything you can do with those buttons from the command line. It has a name that will confuse the bejesus out of Windows users. ipconfig.
Right.
Now we know that on Linux it's ifconfig, and on OS X ifconfig for showing us how the network is configured. And on Windows, to see how the network is configured, it's ipconfig. Well, OS X has its own ipconfig that has nothing whatsoever to do with the Windows one, and its function is to change things on the network more than to show. It can do a little bit of showing, but its main function is changing. So the ipconfig can do lots of things, and man ipconfig will show you them all, but I want to highlight three. So if you just want to turn off... So I was doing this to make my IP, my packets, so that I could do the captures while I was preparing the show notes. So the command sudo ipconfig set name of interface none will turn off an interface. So EN0 or EN1, whatever it's called. So I was using my Ethernet cable, so I was saying ipconfig set EN0 none. And my network turned off.
Yep.
Then I went ipconfig set EN0 DHCP. Turns it back on in the DHCP mode. Packet, 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 packet.
Mine says interface doesn't exist when I put in ENX.
You're right. The X has to be replaced with the actual number of your network.
Oh. So if I said EN0, but I don't know which one's which.
Right. So ifconfig to show you what's what.
Ifconfig?
Ifconfig will show you. Remember, ifconfig is what we've been using all along throughout the series to see everything.
Oh. Okay. Ifconfig.
And you should see one of them has an IP address assigned, and that is the one you want.
Right.
Actually, another quicker way is netstat minus or.
Netstat
space
minus capital
minus
R?
Lowercase or.
Okay.
Okay. Right, while you're doing that, I have to find power.
Okay.
Sleep.
I will attempt to entertain everybody while he's gone without moving my mouth too far from the mic. Let's see. Default, that was not it. That's 10.0.0.1. So let's see. What did he tell me? 10.0.22. Ah, there we go. 10.0.1.10 is... we just knew what mine was. EN...
Okay, well, I'm back.
Yeah, I'm still lost here. I got a whole bunch of numbers.
Okay, right.
I know you said default was not it. Right?
No, default is it. The line with default will end at the very end of the line with an EN something.
Yeah, but that's not my IP address listed there.
No, but we want the EN number.
Okay.
All so right, it'll be EN1, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you
why
say
am IP, I saying none? I'm saying...
None will turn it off. It'll turn off EN1. You'll turn off Wi-Fi.
Look at that. My Wi-Fi turned off.
Okay, then okay. ipconfig set EN1 DHCP will turn it on in DHCP mode.
Okay.
And you may now be about to hit a bug in OS X I hit this morning.
Okay, it didn't come right back.
I was going to say, if your network window is open, OS X has tied itself into a knot. Because if you have system preferences network open while you use this command, you have to reboot your computer.
Oh, thanks, Bart.
I wasn't sure if it was just me, so I may have slightly walked you into that.
Okay, I'm going to try something else first.
This command works flawlessly on wired Ethernet cables. I used it for hours without any problem. But as soon as I tried it on Wi-Fi this morning when I had my network window open, it broke everything.
You broke my old computer. We're not going to be able to type anything more on this one. Cause
that's fine. We don't need anything else in this one.
It will not reboot. This is an Intel Core 2 Duo.
That's fine. So the last command I want to mention... So we have so if we are capturing these packets as they go, we can see what's happening. But if you're coming to a computer after the fact, it's actually very useful to ask it, so what did DHCP tell you 5 hours ago? And so you can say, sudo ipconfig get packet en whatever, and it will just print out the data it got from DHCP.
What do you mean 10 hours ago?
Well, whenever it was, right? So if we weren't running the packet capture at the moment we turned the computer on, we can't have seen it happen because we weren't looking yet. So what do we want to find out what it was told? What did DHCP tell me when I started up?
This isn't going to reboot my network or anything, is it?
No. It's just going to print out the last thing DHCP told your computer on EN, whatever you choose. Which is EN1.
Apparently it didn't tell it anything to EN1. I switched to EN0 on this one. Okay, I see a bunch of glop on screen.
What you should see is the net mask and everything that it was told. Now, if you do, you can do this safely on your live computer, by the way.
Good, because I already did.
Okay, great. It's just going to show you your IP address and stuff as it was given to it by the HCP. So I've highlighted in bold the important stuff. So server identifier is which DHCP server talked to me, which in my case is 192.168.10.1. Mm-hmm. And then in bold, a few lines down, is netmask, router, domain name server, domain.
Yeah. I don't have a domain.
Okay, so your router, your DHCP server, it may not. I have a local DNS domain called local domain. So right. Maybe I'm only offering that out because I'm doing some funny stuff.
Okay, which one is my IP address? YIADDR?
It's going to be further up the page at CIADDR, I think.
No, because that has zeros in it, so I'm guessing it's YIADDR?
Okay, in my case, CIADDR and YIADDR are the same.
Right, in my case, CIADDR, whatever that stands for, is all zeros, so I hope
not. It's the one that's not all zeros.
Okay. So what is that? This is way harder, Bart, than that network window. Why do I like this?
Okay, right. Let's say you're coming to debug a problem, and you weren't there when the computer was turned on. So you can't have used TCP dump to see what was happening because you'd need a time machine.
Okay.
So if you want to answer the question, what did the DHCP tell this computer? Well, here it is. It's like a time machine. It's basically saying, tell me what you were told. Okay, maybe it'll become more obvious when we try to debug stuff, but it's actually important to know what you were told.
Okay.
And that is it, apart from one thing I think we need to mention. There is an elephant in the room again.
Oh, dear.
So do you remember back in the ARP discussion, we said that this is great, it works. Only no one thought to secure it.
Yeah.
This is great, it works. Only no one thought to secure it.
Okay, is that bad?
Yes, it is. You wander into Starbucks. Right, a DHCP server process is teeny tiny. I could run one on my Mac, I could run one on a Linux box, I could run one on my phone if I wanted to. Tiny little thing. It's been around since the 90s, for God's sake. So you could wander into a network and you broadcast asking for DHCP information. You don't know the answer you got is the answer you were supposed to get. What if a bad guy with his little magic box, like we were reading about a couple of weeks ago, one of the things in his toolkit is going to be a fake DHCP server. And if he tells you that his IP address is the router's IP address, but he gives you all the rest of the information correctly, he's just become a man in the middle. By just giving you wrong information over DHCP. He could give you the wrong DNS servers and send you off to malicious DNS server. There is just no way to know. The takeaway, not to frighten the pants off people, is that you should always assume that you are being listened to when you're in a public Wi-Fi, so you should always use a VPN.
Okay, good. We're back to Cloak.
We're back to, exactly. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned Cloak, because that gives me an excuse to mention Overcloak.
Ah, right. Which confused me for a long time.
The reason Overcloak is there is because if someone has used a malicious DHCP server to give you right-looking network addresses, but there's something funny going on, Overcloak will protect you from that weird connection.
And to explain to people, so the symptom where you might have heard me refer to Overcloak was when we were trying to connect to our Wemos and things like that to set them up, was we were on that network, but it wasn't going to the real network. So Cloak turned on Overcloak and cut us off.
Well, the way it actually works is that when you try to connect to Cloak, it puts on Overcloak, brings up the network, tries to prove the network is good, and then takes down Overcloak. So on a network that isn't a real network, that doesn't actually connect to the internet, Overcloak goes up, you never manage to talk to the internet, and Overcloak stays up.
Right, right. Okay, yeah, that's a better way of putting it.
And so overcloak is there because if you were given malicious DHCP responses and you were connecting in a funny sort of network where there was someone giving you false DNS and trying to redirect you to a fake server that wasn't really cloak, the certificates wouldn't match and cloak would go, uh-uh, this is not correct. I am not bringing down overcloak and you are completely protected.
Yay. Yet another reason.
So far we know that we can't trust ARP and we can't trust DHCP. And next week I'll tell you we can't trust DNS.
That's awesome, Bart.
Actually, I've already told you what the conclusion is by saying that next week we're going to look at DNS so that the week after we can tie it all together with a whole bunch of commands to help you fix people's network problems.
Cool. That sounds like fun. Real quickly, I know Cloak is not the only game in town. Do other DNS companies that write applications for us?
You mean VPN?
VPN, sorry.
It will depend a bit. So the symptom will be different. So with Overcloak, it's all very nice and hidden from the user. So it's actually very nice. Basically, right, the reason I love Cloak is because what they're actually using is OpenVPN. So the technology under the hood is OpenVPN, which is open source, well-trusted, great technology. But like so much in the open source world, it's a bit techie, a bit rough around the edges. So what Cloak have done is instead of reinventing the wheel, they've taken a really good wheel and built a great UI around it.
Okay.
And so if you're using raw OpenVPN, you'll get a certificate mismatch. So it'll tell you, the certificate the server offered me is not the right one. And then you should, like a good person, when you get a certificate warning, say, oh, no, don't trust.
But that's a lot more work than having Overcloak never let you get to it in the first place, right?
Exactly, because that way the user isn't asked to make a technical decision. So whereas if you're using raw OpenVPN, you are presented with technical information that it's assumed you know how to answer.
Right, right.
Which you may not.
Well, this so, was yeah, fun, so Bart. I was just saying, this is really fun. I understood everything, I think.
Get used to more like this, because like I said, last week was the difficult one. But last week done, we're on the downhill slope here. We almost understand how our network hangs together completely.
Wow.
Right. I presume whenever we do DNS, which is, I've completely lost track of time, but whenever it is, when we have the DNS piece done, we really are, we got it. We know how our network works at that stage.
Wow. That's crazy. I am excited to be on the downhill slope because I feel empowered, Bart.
And the good news is that, you know, the way this protocol was all ask, question, get answer, it was sort of a conversation.
Yeah.
DHCP is the same sort of deal. Hello, DHCP server, I'd like to know something. Well, here you go. It's a very similar, nice, chatty English.
You mean DNS will be?
What did I say?
DHCP. We just did DHCP.
Yeah. Yes. Sorry. Yes. You're absolutely right. DNS is that same sort of friendly, chatty protocol.
Very cool. All right, Bart. Well, it is before Christmas for you and me, so I'm going to say Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays and all that, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Well, and I hope you have a peaceful and restful Christmas. Eat too much. Drink a bit too much.
There you go.
Have too much fun. So the listeners are going to have a great big food belly hangover when they hear this, aren't they?
Yes, they will.
I hope the listeners had a great Christmas and the very best wishes for 2015.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
No, it's not how we finish, Bart.
Until next time, happy computing.
Okay, I thought that was funny. I enjoyed that. Well, I would say I should probably apologize for when at this point I'm looking at an hour and 47 minutes on the clock, but every other podcast either took the week off or they said, oh, we'll just compile a bunch of stuff we already did and you get to hear reruns, but not the No Silicast. And it's because of the No Silicast community. We have thanks to Alistair and Dor and Stephen and Nightwise and Steve for doing all these great reviews so that I could relax, but you guys still got a great show. Oh, and Bart, of course, going extra long and doing a great meaty show. I thought that DHCP stuff was fantastic. And, of course, many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills, the makers of Clarify over at clarify-it.com, and Hover for your domain names over at hover.com. Don't forget, last week for the coupon code PODFEET12. That's not written in the show notes anywhere. Don't go looking for it. It's not in there. You can only hear it here. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions like Timo did, and send comments and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter @podfeet. And go over to the No Silicast Google Plus community. podfeet.com/Google+, and put in your vote about what do you think about Security Lite. Do you like it? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Are there parts you like, parts you don't? Give him your opinion, because he really wants a feedback. And when Bart says he wants feedback, he's serious. You cannot hurt his feelings. He really wants to know. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show like Haley did for the first time, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.